On this day in 1954, the Orioles played their first American League game in Baltimore. On April 15th, a Thursday, the team drew an estimated 350,000 spectators to a parade through the city and a capacity crowd to brand new Memorial Stadium on 33rd Street for a game against the Chicago White Sox. As we mark 60 years of Major League Baseball in Baltimore, our guest is Bill Madden, veteran sports writer for the New York Daily News and author now of a book about baseball in 1954. In that season, Bill Madden says, Willie Mays and the first generation of black superstars changed Major League Baseball forever. He'll tell us why he reached that conclusion on midday. First, the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. Today is the 60th anniversary of Major League Baseball in Baltimore, April 15th, 1954. A capacity crowd of more than 43,000 fans attended a game at Memorial Stadium on 33rd Street, brand new Memorial Stadium, still unfinished Memorial Stadium on 33rd Street, a game between the Orioles and the Chicago White Sox. Baltimore's new team had just made the move from St. Louis with the hopes that relocating to a new city would reinvigorate the struggling franchise, the former St. Louis Browns. That day, the energy was high in Baltimore, and the Orioles defeated the Sox 3-1 in the home game opener. And while the end result of the inaugural Orioles season was not so great, in fact, it was just as bad as it had been in St. Louis, 1954 marked the beginning of a long tradition of Baltimore baseball. Today is also Jackie Robinson Day, a celebration of racial integration in Major League Baseball. 67 years ago, April 15th, 1947, the color line was broken when Jackie Robinson moved from the Negro Leagues to play for the Brooklyn Dodgers. But the story of racial integration in baseball didn't stop there. It took the work of many more managers and players over several years to make baseball less segregated and for the teams and the public to accept an integrated game. In Bill Madden's new book, the veteran sports writer examines the year of 1954 and argues that it was a breakout year for black baseball players. Bill Madden's book explores the political, cultural, and sports events and personalities that shaped America's pastime in an era of rapid change. 1954, the year Willie Mays and the first generation of black superstars changed Major League Baseball, is Bill Madden's sixth book. It's published by DeCapo Press. Bill is a longtime sports writer and columnist for the New York Daily News, and he served several times on the Historical Overview Committee for the Baseball Hall of Fame. And he joins us this hour of midday. Bill, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to get you on the show.
It's my pleasure as well. Thank you.
I'm so glad you did this book, but I wonder what the process was for getting to this project, 1954.
Well, this book has been in my head probably for 10 to 15 years. It's a book I just always wanted to write. I just didn't get around to doing it until this past year when my agent found a good publisher in DeCapo Press. And so it was the first baseball season that I remember as a kid. I grew up in northern New Jersey in a Yankee household, and we were just used to the Yankees always being in the World Series. They had won 5 straight World Championships going into the 1954 season. And I remember as a kid wondering, when were the Yankees going to get in first place and fulfill our divine right of winning the pennant? And it never happened. They were in first place, I think, for like maybe 3 days the entire 54 season, as the Cleveland Indians just ran away with the pennant. Won a record 111 games, an American League record, and beat the Yankees by 8.5 lengths.
You know, there's an untold story there, too. That's what you were thinking, between 1947 and Jackie Robinson, and when black players started populating more of the teams. There was another 7 years there.
Well, that was it. I mean, like I said, we had been used to the Yankees being in the World Series all those years, And here comes 1954. Willie Mays comes back from the Army. He's still just a kid with the Giants. And the Giants go on to win the pennant in 1954, and then they defeat this vaunted Cleveland Indians team, which, by the way, was led by Larry Doby, the first black player in the American League, who followed shortly thereafter, followed Jackie. And so you had, for the first time ever, a World Series in which black players were on both teams. Because the Yankees were an all-white team and one of the last teams to basically embrace integration in baseball, that's the way the World Series had always been. The other thing is the fact that the Yankees had won all those years, and now Cleveland and the Giants are in this World Series, and it was just a both Mays and Larry Doby had just sensational seasons that year. Mays was a National League Most Valuable Player, and Doby led the American League in home runs and RBIs, and for some reason did not win the MVP, but he probably should have won it.
I want to
So it was a was a true breakthrough season for the black players in baseball.
I want to just step back, Bill, and go back to our opening here on Baltimore and the Major League Baseball coming to Baltimore, the St. Louis Browns moving to Baltimore and becoming the Orioles. But it's very interesting. The setting of the times is very important to the book that you've written here. So I wish you'd talk a little bit about the backdrop. Here's Baltimore, the northernmost southern city, the southernmost northern city. It depends on your point of view. But certainly in terms of how black players were treated here when the Orioles arrived, this was still a segregated city. This was still a southern city.
Exactly. Well, another thing I might add is 7 years after Jackie broke the color line, half of baseball, 8 out of the 16 teams, still had not integrated by 1954. Baltimore, of course, was they inherited the Browns when Bill Veeck was forced out as the Browns owner, and he sold to a group of Baltimore businessmen headed by an attorney named Clarence Miles. And so the Browns came to Baltimore, and at the time, the Orioles had only one black player when they first started out in 54. It was a little left-hander named Jehosie Hurd. But getting back a little bit, before the season even began, the governor of Maryland, Theodore McKeldin, had a commission of interracial, directing on interracial problems, and he held a meeting with the Baltimore hoteliers because he was very concerned over the fact that Baltimore still had was holding firm to segregation in its hotels. And he basically he met with these hotel owners, and he said to them, look, we're a big league city now. We have got to change. We've got to adapt to the changing times in America. And the hoteliers listened to him, and then they held a meeting of their own, and they came back and they told him, we're not going to change our policies here. And the attorney, a man named Charles D. Harris, the attorney for the hotel owners, countered McKeldin's argument by stating, the hotels are in the business of making a profit, which they stand to lose if they go along with public opinion. So that was Baltimore's introduction to Major League Baseball. It was not a very they started off on a rather disappointing front as far as their stance, as far as integration was concerned. And actually, the Baltimore hotels did not get integrated until 1957, when the Sheraton Belvedere was the first to admit black patrons.
I want to follow that story about Theodore McKeldin, who was governor of Maryland, also was mayor of Baltimore, a Republican, who implored the hoteliers to open up for the for black players. I want to follow that with a quote from your book from Joe Durham, one of only two black players on the first Baltimore Orioles team. So, Bill, I'm just going to read this quote for our listeners here in Maryland from Joe Durham. This is a quote. I got in late at night from San Antonio and checked into the Southern Hotel, which was the hotel the Orioles put all their players up. The next morning when I went downstairs to have breakfast, a black bellhop came up to me and asked, how did you get here? When I told him, He quickly ushered me out the door to a house on Pressman Street in the black neighborhood, and I then got a room at the all-black York Hotel. I'm probably the first black person to stay in a segregated Baltimore hotel. Those 3 weeks at the York in September were a very lonely experience, and I was grateful that one of my teammates, Don Larson, former Yankee, would pick me up every day at the Casino nightclub around the corner from the York Hotel and drive me to and from the ballpark. That's what it was like for a black player for the Orioles in 1954. 3 years, as you say, Bill, before the hotels were desegregated.
Yes, I was so glad that I was able to find and locate Joe Durham because Jehosie Hurd, as I told you, the little left-hander who was their first black player, he had been released midway through the season. And so when Durham came up in September, he was a late-season call-up, the Orioles were back to being an all-white team. And so he was essentially their first significant black player because I think he hit the first home run by a black player on the Orioles. And anyway, I tracked him down. He still lives in Baltimore, and he's still very much alive and vibrant and just a terrific guy. And he worked for the Orioles for many years in various different capacities. He may still be working for them in the community relations department.
And I assume the other players for visiting teams and whatnot, all, if there were any black players, they all had to stay at this York Hotel as well, or at a private home.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. And that was an eyesore for the American League as far for Baltimore, as far as the American League teams were concerned. Fortunately, this was long before interleague play, so it only affected American League players.
You mentioned, Bill, that 8 of the 16 teams still hadn't integrated as of 1954. Just to list those, the Yankees, the Pittsburgh Pirates, Boston Red Sox, Detroit Tigers, Cincinnati Reds, St. Louis Cardinals, the Phillies in Philadelphia, and the Washington Senators. They still had not integrated as of spring training 1954. We're going to take a break here and continue our conversation with veteran sports writer Bill Madden in just a moment. Bill Madden's book is 1954, the year Willie Mays and the first generation of black superstars changed Major League Baseball. It's also, of course, the year that the Orioles arrived here in Baltimore. If you'd like to join our conversation, please feel free to give us a call or write us an email. If you have a question for Bill Madden, 410-662-8780, toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309, or you can send us an email, midday@wypr.org. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodrigues here. You can go to my Facebook page and see a nice photograph of the Orioles parade that took place on this day 60 years ago, April 15th, 1954, The team got off a train at Camden Station. They had arrived from Detroit, where they actually opened the season, and for their home opener at Memorial Stadium, where the cement was still wet in some parts of the stadium, they had this great parade up through town and to the stadium. You can see a photograph of that on my Facebook page. Spending this hour with Bill Madden, talking about 1954. The year Willie Mays and the first generation of black superstars changed Major League Baseball. This is a new book by the veteran sports writer Bill Madden that's out from DeCapo Press. So, Bill, I want to talk about Willie Mays in just a moment here, and actually a little bit about Bill Veeck, too, as we move on to talk about some of the personalities of this particular year. But also I think I ought to talk a little bit about the history, the background of, you know, the segregated United States. And here we have just a month after the baseball season begins, the Supreme Court making a pretty important ruling when it comes to segregation and desegregation in the United States.
Well, yes. I mean, this whole book takes place under the backdrop of Brown versus Board of Education. And I guess what people may not realize, but in 1954, this was still a very racially divided nation, especially in the South. And so you had situations like Joe Durham coming up from minor leagues to supposedly Major League Baseball and arriving at his hotel in Baltimore and not only being escorted out of that hotel and put to an all-black hotel, but also coming across the same indignities that he had to endure himself growing up in Newport News, Virginia. As he told me, he said, you know, I wasn't prepared for the fact that we still had separate bathrooms in Baltimore, and we still weren't allowed to change our clothes in department stores and things like that. And so all of this was going on, and here we have, as I said before, baseball was still only half integrated by 1954. So there was a lot of things going on, and the Brown versus Board of Education decision was kind of bringing all of this to the forefront because of all the demonstrations and protests and everything that were going on in the South.
When you go back to 1947 and come forward, 1947, Jackie Robinson, Larry Doby gets to the American League in which year? In 54?
No, Larry Doby came up right after Robinson.
Right, okay.
He came up in late 47.
Okay. And then you have other teams integrating, one here, one there. We get up to about half of the teams, and then much smaller, of course, Major League Baseball at the time, year by year.
Yeah, that
right?
was the thing. That was the thing. When Jackie broke the color line, everybody thought that there would be just a deluge of players coming out of the Negro Leagues and going into the Major Leagues. It turns out that it was not a deluge. It was more like a trickle.
Mm-hmm.
And there was. I think the percentage of black players in baseball didn't really get up to over 7% until beginning in 1954.
I mentioned Bill Veeck, and you mentioned him earlier, and I wanted to talk about him a little bit here because in reading a biography of him a couple of years ago and then again in your book, you know, this is, of course, very one of the most colorful characters in all of baseball history. The owner, Veeck as in Wreck.
Well, that was the title of his
yeah,
book,
right.
Veeck as in Wreck.
But he was owner of the Cleveland Indians. Then he goes out and he becomes the owner of the St. Louis Browns. And he actually was pushing for integration pretty early, wasn't he?
Well, Veeck was the one who brought Doby to the Indians.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, Veeck was big on integration. There was a story, it's never been actually proven, but there was a story that Veeck, sometime back in the 40s, had tried or was talking about trying to buy the Philadelphia Phillies with the idea of stocking the team entirely with players from the Negro Leagues. Veeck kind of alluded to that on a few occasions, in fact, including in his book, but he never got very detailed about it. And so we don't know if that was ever going to, that was really a reality or not. But the fact is, Veeck was in the forefront of integration in baseball with what he did with the Indians. He brought Doby there, then he brought Satchel Paige, the Negro League legendary pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
And they were both very, certainly Paige was, very instrumental in the Indians winning the World Championship in 1948.
You know, I always thought it was sad that he didn't come to Baltimore with the St. Louis Browns as they became the Baltimore Orioles. He wanted to. And he later, yeah, he had a presence in Maryland. He had a home on the eastern shore of Maryland, the other side of the bay. And
that's right.
You know, reporters used to go over there, sports writers would go interview him from time to time because he was always great for an interview. But here was a guy who owned the St. Louis Browns, wanted to bring him to Baltimore, but he couldn't. The other owners were what, opposed to him? And
well, what happened was the Yankees hated Bill Veeck, and he was always tweaking their noses because, you know, he looked at the Yankees as the establishment, and he was the all-time anti-establishment owner. With all his crazy ideas, he had this grandstand manager's day, sent a midget up to the plate one time, Eddie Gaedel. And Veeck was always doing these great, wild, and crazy promotions. And the Yankees, of course, frowned on all of this. And in addition to his ideas about sharing gate receipts, they didn't like that idea either.
I bet.
Which is what everybody does today. But anyway, so Veeck was in a bind in St. Louis. He thought he had the upper hand there when he owned the Browns because the Browns owned the ballpark there. But and then the St. Louis Cardinals owner, Fred Tsai, got into all kinds of trouble with the government, and he was forced to sell the team. And Veeck thought that this would be okay because Tsai was an underfunded guy. But all of a sudden, out of nowhere, comes Gussie Bush and the Budweiser Brewery. and they buy the Cardinals. And right there, as soon as that happened, Vex said, I'm dead. I got to get out of here. And so he tried. He wanted to go to Milwaukee. That was his first choice. But the Braves had the territorial rights in Milwaukee, and the owner of the Braves, who were then in Boston, Lou Perini, had already staked out Milwaukee as a place where he wanted to move his team. So Vec was blocked there. And so his next choice was Baltimore. And the only problem with Baltimore was the owners weren't going to approve him to go anywhere. And he thought he had the votes to go to Baltimore, and they had a meeting of the American League owners, and Vec walked into the meeting thinking he had the votes and walked out stunned when it turns out they voted him down. I forget what the vote was, but it was something like 6-1 with one abstention, I think it was. And he couldn't believe it. And then he realized that the Yankees had basically wielded their considerable power among the weakling American League teams, most of whom, like them, most of which, like them, had not chosen to integrate yet.
Right.
The American League was very slow to integrate. So anyway, Vec struck out in Baltimore, and he had no choice but to sell the team to Clarence Miles and his syndicate.
Just for the record, the Orioles in their first season were 54-100, 54 wins, 100 losses, as bad as the Browns had been the previous year. Still, they drew more than a million fans to Memorial Stadium, to Memorial Stadium, and they managed to make a profit of more than $800,000 in their inaugural season here. We're speaking with Bill Madden. His book is 1954, The Year Willie Mays and the First Generation of Black Superstars Changed Major League Baseball. We have to talk about Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, Ernie Banks. We've mentioned Larry Doby. Let's go to Willie Mays now. I'd love to talk about Willie Mays because he ended up being in the World Series that year, one of eight black players on both teams, four in each team in the World Series of 1954. When did he come up? His rookie season had been a little earlier, right, Bill?
Right. Willie came up in 51, and he immediately galvanized the Giants that year with just this. He was a 21-year-old kid, and just this surge of energy that he brought to that team. And, of course, the 51 Giants staged the greatest comeback in baseball history to win the pennant. And even though Mays was not a principal in that, he was certainly his presence as their center fielder was the guy that basically, as Leo DeRocher, the manager, said, he was the one that changed the whole chemistry on this team. And then he went away to the Army in 52, and the Giants subsequently fell down to fifth place in 1953. And so there was much anticipation in the spring of 1954 for Willie's return to the Giants. DeRocher had been basically telling his players all spring, we're going to get Willie Mays back, and this is going to be the difference maker. This guy is a special player, and we need to really embrace him because he's the guy that's going to take us to the promised land. And he really overhyped Willie, but it turned out there was no overhyping Willie because he lived up to all of the hype.
Who was Piper Davis, and how does he figure into the Willie Mays story?
Well, Piper Davis was Willie's manager with the Birmingham Barons. He was one of the great players in the Negro Leagues. And it was Piper Davis who really taught Willie the rudiments of baseball. He worked long and hard teaching him how to hit a curveball, for one thing. And he worked with him in the outfield and learning to throw to the cutoff man and all of those things. And Piper Davis actually was hoping he himself was going to get to the major leagues. The Red Sox offered him a chance to work out with them, and they actually did sign him, and they sent him to a minor league team, and he was hitting well over 300 for that minor league team, and then they released him without any explanation. They claimed that it was a budgetary reason. Obviously, it was a lot more than that because he certainly had played well enough down there to deserve a promotion. So Piper Davis was like a second father to Willie, and he was probably more instrumental in his development than anybody, really, because by the time he was signed by the Giants, he was just about major league ready.
Bill, you've been a sports writer a long time. For folks who never had the pleasure of seeing Willie Mays play, could you just describe him as a player?
Well, he was the greatest player I ever saw. And, you know, I guess maybe you know, I'd like to see Steve Trout 10 years from now. Maybe he'll approach what I saw in Willie. But Willie was, he was your consummate five-tool player. And by that, I mean, as DeRocha said, he could do everything. He could hit. He could hit with power. He could run. He could throw. He could steal bases. There was nothing on a ball field that Willie Mays couldn't do. That was a DeRocher quote, and it was 100% accurate. He was that kind of a player. And plus the fact that he just played the game with such a exuberance. That's why this Giants team in 1954 was such a special team, because of the fact that the core players on this team, Alvin Dark, Whitey Lockman, Don Mueller, Dusty Rhodes, and Davey Williams, the second baseman, were all Southern white players. And yet, they embraced Willie Mays like he was one of their own. And Dusty Rhodes once told me, I did the last interview he ever did, and he was, of course, the hero of the 54 World Series. Dusty also grew up in Alabama like Willie did. He also picked cotton in Alabama like Willie did, although, as Dusty said, he picked cotton with the black folks down there. And he said to me, he said, there was just something so special about Willie. He said, he was like my brother. And he said, I stayed in his house long after we retired. I would visit him. I would stay with him for weeks on end. And he was just such a special person to me.
Bill, how much of that you think is owing to Willie Mays' personality and how much to his superstar status, the fact that he was such a great player?
Well, I think both. I think it's very interesting because Jackie Robinson, by contrast, was not beloved by his teammates the way Willie was. And I think the reason for that was because Jackie was obviously very socially conscious. He knew what he was there for. He was there to break the color line, and yes, he was there to hopefully lead the Dodgers to a world championship. But he was also there to basically press the social issues, to call everyone's attention to that. And a lot of that caused resentment among his fellow players, especially the Southerners on that Dodger team, and opposing players as well. Whereas Willie just came into the game, and Willie was kind of like an innocent. He came into the game, and he was not about social issues. He was not about anything other than playing baseball with a verve like few had ever seen before. And I talked to Willie about this when I interviewed him up at the Hall of Fame about 10 years ago for this book. That's how long I've been working on this. And I started to ask him about this special bond between Willie and all these Southern whites on the Giants that year. And he immediately cut me off. He says, I ain't talking about no social issues. I don't talk about social issues. He says, you want to talk about Leo? You want to talk about the World Series in 54, you want to talk about the catch? I'll talk about all of that stuff, but I ain't talking about no social issues. Mm. That's just Willie. He wasn't about that.
Bill Madden is our guest in this hour of Midday. His book is 1954, The Year Willie Mays and the First Generation of Black Superstars Changed Major League Baseball. This is Dan Rodrigues. Bill, we're going to take another short break. We'll come back and pick up our conversation. 410-662-8780 is the phone number for Midday. If you have a question for Bill about this particular year that he's examined in his book, 1954, our toll-free long-distance number, good from anywhere in the country, 866-661-9309. Or the Midday email address, you can address that comment or question that way too, midday@wypr.org. And welcome back. Dan Rodrigues here. It's the Midday Show. 1954, April 15th, 1954, the 60th anniversary today of the Orioles' inaugural season in Baltimore when the Orioles arrived in Baltimore for their home opener. We have with us Bill Madden, veteran sports writer, who's written a book about that year, 1954, the year Willie Mays and the first generation of black superstars changed Major League Baseball. I was really interested in the Ernie Banks story. Ernie Banks, what a great player he was with the Chicago Cubs I saw him play in the 60s on television. You know, that's my only experience with him. I thought he was such a great player and a great man. But he had some really interesting comments about being a rookie in 1954. Bill, do you want me to just quote from the book here what Ernie Banks said? I think it's pretty interesting. Let me do that, and then you can comment further. He has sort of this ambivalence about being in Major League Baseball. He said, I'll be honest, I was a little uncertain about being there. I wanted to stay with the Monarchs. That's a reference to a Negro League team. He says, I was raised in Dallas in a time of segregation. I didn't understand integration. This was a whole different world for me. I had no fear. I learned from the Bible, but I had lived in a black community, went to black school, played sports at a black YMCA, played baseball for a black team with a black manager, and that was all I'd ever known.
Yeah, that was a revelation to me. I never expected to hear any of these black players coming out of the Negro Leagues saying they had trepidation about going to the major leagues. Mm-hmm. I fully expected all of them to be telling me what a great day in their lives it was when they learned that Jackie had broken the color line. And Banks, of course, he was a lot like Willie as well, in that, as he said to me, he says, I was an innocent. He was this young kid who had really not really known a whole lot of what came with segregation, as far as, like he said, he grew up in an all-black environment. And he really didn't know what, you know, prejudice was, or at least not firsthand the way a lot of these other people did, mm-hmm. His fellow Negro League players. And I guess in a way, when he was with the Monarchs, he was kind of protected because of the fact that he was clearly their best player. And both he and Hank Aaron both broke in 1954. There's a whole chapter, as you know, with both the two of them. I kind of lumped them together because of the fact that they both went on to combined to hit over 1,300 home runs between them.
Yeah, amazing.
So that was another reason why this was another reason why this was such a significant season, because they both had very good rookie years in 54.
But you know, Ernie Banks, he isn't speaking out of fear. He says, I had no fear. It wasn't fear that gave him this sort of ambivalence about moving up to the show.
No, I think what he was saying was he was very comfortable in the Negro Leagues. Yeah. And he would have been just as happy to stay there his entire career. Of course, he quickly realized that there was no money to be made in the Negro Leagues compared to what he was going to be making in the major leagues. And of course, you know, and as time went along, once he adjusted, he went through his period of adjustment. And the Cubs, in that respect, really helped him, because prior to signing Ernie, they had signed Gene Baker, another black player, who was also a shortstop, and probably should have been in the major leagues long before Ernie got there along with him in 1954. Actually, they both came up at the end of 53. Baker was signed earlier in the 50s, and because the Cubs had this other shortstop, Roy Smalley, who the owner, Phil Wrigley, was just really loved this guy for some reason. He wasn't a very good shortstop. But bottom line was, they made Gene Baker play shortstop for their AAA team in Los Angeles for 3 years. All 3 years he was an all-star shortstop there, but could never get promoted. So when he did get promoted, that was when they had signed Banks. And the real reason that they promoted Gene Baker then was because they wanted somebody else to kind of look after Banks, kind of an elder statesman for him. And so they moved Gene Baker from shortstop to second base.
Oh, I see. So the Cubs had Ernie Banks at short and Gene Baker, also black, also from the Monarchs, at second.
Which was the first ever all-black shortstop second base double play combo.
Wow. 1954 is the book by Bill Madden, our guest in this hour of midday. Well, we might as well move right on to Hank Aaron here. This was his rookie year, and I was amused by this. He came in subbing for an injured Milwaukee Braves, Bobby Thompson.
Right.
Yeah,
well, this was a very interesting story, because, again, all of this weaves together, and I'll try to make it short here, but Bobby Thompson wound up with the Braves because the Braves needed a power-hitting outfielder very badly in the winter of 53. And they wound up trading two pitchers to the Giants, Johnny Antonelli and Don Little, both of them left-handers. And Johnny Antonelli went on to be, if there had been a Cy Young Award winner that year, he would have won it because he was the most important ingredient pitching-wise that the Giants had that year in winning the pennant. Meanwhile, Bobby Thompson goes over to the Braves, and at the time, Hank Aaron had been he played the previous year at A-ball in Jacksonville. He had a great year there. He was a second baseman there. And he came to camp, and they had already told him that they wanted him to start playing in the outfield. But he had no thoughts of making the team because they had a very full outfield with Bobby Thompson and Billy Bruton and a couple of other guys there. They had, you know, four good veteran outfielders. Andy Pafko was another one. So he comes to camp, and he's doing very well there. In fact, he's hitting some home runs in camp that people were just, you know, jumping out of the dugout to take another look at, so to speak. And then all of a sudden, Bobby Thompson is sliding into third base in a spring training game, and he breaks his ankle.
Oh, wow.
And Aaron is watching this. He had been in the game earlier, and he'd come out of the game, and he's watching this from the dugout. And one of the pitchers on the Braves, Bob Buell, came over to him, and he said, "You just made the ball club."
and that was Hank Aaron's rookie year.
So that's how Hank Aaron wound up having his debut in 1954, because he probably would have gone to Atlanta, the Braves' AAA farm team. And that's a whole nother story, because the owner of the whole Southern League at that time was segregated. There had been no black players in that league. And Aaron probably would have been the first one, because, in fact, the owner of the Atlanta Crackers was looking forward to getting Aaron on his team. It was because he'd been at A-ball the year before, it was the natural evolution that he would go to AAA. And because of Bobby Thompson breaking his ankle, all of history changed as far as the Braves and Hank Aaron was concerned.
Hey, Bill, I want to stop here and just ask you about the most progressive teams when it comes to integration. Of course, Branch Rickey and the Brooklyn Dodgers, we know that story. But it looks like it was mostly in the National League where this was happening. You mentioned that the Cubs had Ernie Banks and Gene Baker, two black men, two black players in the same infield. Were there other teams that had more than one or two or three players who were black?
Well, the Giants did, of course, and the Braves did. When Aaron made the team, they had George Crowe, a first baseman. They had Billy Bruton, was one of their best players, their center fielder. And they had another outfielder, a spare outfielder named Jim Pendleton. So Hank at least had plenty of company all that spring and during the course of the season. And Billy Bruton was Hank Aaron's Gene Baker, and he took him under his wing and basically, you know, prepared him for what he was going to go through as far as the indignities that he was still going to have to endure, even though he was in the major leagues. Billy Bruton was to Hank Aaron what Monty Irvin was to Willie Mays and what Gene Baker was to Ernie Banks. And then what's interesting is from 1947, when Jackie broke the color line, to 1953, the American League won seven straight World Series. But then, beginning in 1954 and all the way to 1976, the National League won 13 World Series to the American League's 10. And that was all the result of these evolving black superstars. You had Mays, Aaron, Banks in 1954. And then in 1955, Roberto Clemente joined the Pirates. 1956, Frank Robinson joined the Reds. In 1958, you had Orlando Cepeda joining the Giants and Bob Gibson in 1959 with the Cardinals and Willie McCovey in 1959 with the Giants. All these players went on to the Hall of Fame, and they all were perennial all-stars, and that's the other fact here as to why I feel that 54 changed baseball forever, because from 1960 to 1982, the National League won 24 out of 26 All-Star games.
I remember that period.
All of which these players were the key players
right.
in them.
Yep. 1954, we also mentioned Larry Doby earlier, first black player to hit a home run in an All-Star game.
Right, exactly. And so, you know,
yeah, I can see I can see why you focused on this year. I want to ask you, Bill Madden, about your team, the Yankees. What was going on there? I know Casey Stengel was the manager. They had this great run of world championships, and then it didn't happen in 1954. So how long did it take the Yankees to integrate?
Well, the Yankees were the big holdouts in that they were the world champions. And the book begins with the Yankees announcing this big trade that they made in January of that year, in which they traded Vic Power, who was their number one prospect in the minor leagues. He was a black Puerto Rican, and he was a very gifted player. And they traded him to the Athletics for a first baseman and a starting pitcher. And there was a lot of questions made to George Weiss, the general manager, as to why they would be trading Power. And Weiss finally got annoyed at all this, you know, insinuations that the Yankees traded him because they didn't want to promote him and they didn't want to integrate. And at one point, he basically tells all these writers to the effect that, you know what, we've won 5 straight world championships. We've beaten Jackie Robinson and the Dodgers 3 times in those world championships. We'll integrate when we feel like integrating. We're not going to integrate when you people tell us we should. And that was the Yankees' attitude. And then, of course, they went through the entire 54 season, never able to catch the Indians. And the irony of all of this was the fact that as soon as the season was over, they announced that they were promoting Elston Howard to the Major League roster. And that, in 1955, that was when the Yankees integrated with Elston Howard.
Elston Howard. I'm glad you mentioned Elston Howard, because it gives me an opportunity to mention Sam Lacy, the late great sports writer for the Baltimore Afro-American and a crusader for equal rights. Sam Lacy, who took Casey Stengel to task, I think, in 54, right, for not promoting
Yes, he
Elston.
Did.
He could have brought up Elston Howard as a catcher.
Exactly. Well, of course, after the Power trade, there was a lot. The Yankees were, this whole racial situation was engulfing the Yankees, and especially Casey Stengel that spring, because of the fact that, you know, once they traded Vic Power, the next guy in line, as far as a top prospect, a black player, was Elston Howard, who was clearly a major league
catcher
caliber, you know. Well, he was both a catcher and an outfielder.
Outfielder, right.
And so, you know, Sam Lacy wrote this column in spring training, what are the Yankees going to do now? Now that they've gotten rid of Vic Power, how are they going to degrade Elston Howard? Well, he took that from the fact that during the spring of 54, the Yankees decided that they wanted to really give Elston Howard a good education on catching, and they assigned Bill Dickey, their famous Hall of Fame catcher, to work with him. Well, anyway, apparently what happened was Howard and Sam Lacy got into this conversation off campus, so to speak, and you could see by the way Lacy wrote the article that Elston had pretty much unloaded on him as far as his frustrations. Because he felt he could make the team as an outfielder, but why are they making me a catcher when they have Yogi Berra, who's in his prime? He'd already won one MVP award. He would win 2 more.
Right.
And, you know, what are they going to do with me? And Lacy interpreted this as the fact that this is what they were doing. They were burying Elston Howard. And he wrote this scathing article, and he basically called the Yankees racist. He said that Casey Stengel was a racist for having, you know, taking Elston and trying to make him into a catcher. Why is he doing this? And he doesn't quote Elston directly in any of this, but he indicates that Elston would much prefer staying in the outfield if that was a way to get to the big leagues rather than trying to become a catcher. So anyway, after this article came out, fortunately it was in the Baltimore... The Baltimore Afro-American, which was not obviously a widely circulated paper back then, other than in the black communities around the country. And so it didn't get a lot of attention, except for the fact that because it was, you know, a black newspaper, Elston found out about it, and he was embarrassed because It made him look like he was basically complaining, and he was also scared because he was afraid that, you know, he was going to be labeled a malcontent by the Yankee front office. That was one of the things they said about Vic Power. You know, they said he was dating white women, and he was a problem. He had work habit problems and things like that. And so Elston was afraid that now they were going to take this article and basically, pin that on him and retard his progress to the big leagues. And so he confronted Sam Lacy in front of all the other writers in spring training, right at the end of spring training, and basically screamed at him and said, "Sam, how could you do this? You know this is all bull. How could you write this stuff?" And so that, in turn, got some of the other Chicago, the other black newspapers across the country, the one in Chicago.
The Chicago Defender,
mm-hmm. Right. They wrote a whole editorial defending Sam Lacy and basically saying that Elston Howard, he picked on the wrong guy here when he tries to make out Sam Lacy as being some sort of a liar.
Interesting. And then Elston Howard did come up the next year.
Yes, he did. Yeah. He came up in 55, and lo and behold, the Yankees returned to the World Series, only that year they didn't win it.
Hey, Bill, we got a few minutes left here. I want to savor something here in the last few minutes of our hour together, and that is the cover of the book, which is a great cover, I think. It's a famous photograph of Willie Mays making an over-the-shoulder basket catch, number 24, deep, deep, deep in the Polo Grounds outfield, making an amazing catch in the World Series of 1954, the New York Giants against the Cleveland Indians. I wish you'd just set this up a little bit for us. Who's on base? Which game is this? How many outs there are? And what does Willie do?
Well, this was the pivotal part of the World Series this would never have happened if it was in Cleveland Stadium, because in Cleveland Stadium it would have been a home run for Vic Wertz. In the Giants Stadium it was more like a 480-foot out, and it was because of that there were two runners on base, and Vic Wertz was the Cleveland's hottest hitter. He was a left-handed hitter, and he hits this ball that looked like it was going to basically drive in two runs at least, and the Indians would win game one of the World Series. Instead, Willie makes this fabulous catch. He turns around, he throws the ball into the infield and prevents either of the runners from advancing. And it has gone down in history as the greatest catch ever because of that, because, you know, it happened under these circumstances. Ironically, earlier that season, Larry Doby of the Indians made a catch that people who were there who witnessed it said was the greatest catch they had ever seen. It was in Cleveland Stadium, but it was on an ordinary Saturday afternoon game. There was no television, and there were no pictures taken of this catch.
You know, Doby never got credit for that, but this thing, I'm reading the numbers here. 460 feet, it's estimated,
right.
Vic Wertz hit that ball. This is the Polo Grounds. I've looked at pictures of the Polo Grounds just recently, and this sort of bathtub shape of the whole thing with this deep outfield, and yet 279 feet, I think, along the lines, right? As deep as 480 feet.
Which is where Dusty Rhodes' home run went. And Dusty Rhodes won that game one with his 10th inning home run off Bob Lemon, which went down the right field line 279 feet. Barely made it over the fence. And so that was the whole irony, and that was the turning point of the entire World Series was game one, because as Al Rosen, the Indians, so bitterly told me, he said if that game had been in our stadium, Vic Wertz's ball would have been a three-run homer, and Dusty Rhodes's ball would have been a short fly pop-out. And that would have ended the game.
And there's a picture in there of the Dusty Rhodes home run. You can see how close it was. Bill, we're out of time, but thank you for savoring, especially that last catch, that last story, the catch by Willie Mays, which makes the cover of Bill Madden's book, 1954, the year Willie Mays and the first generation of black superstars changed Major League Baseball forever. Thank you, Bill. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show.
Okay, thank you very much.
Bill Madden of the New York Daily News, longtime sports writer with his book. I hope you enjoyed our first hour of midday today. We're going to take a break now for lunch provided by Bagby Pizza Company, located in the historic Bagby Building near Harbor East in Baltimore. serving thin crust pizza, gourmet sandwiches, pasta, salads, and more. Stay tuned for the news and then the second hour of our show.